Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can support us on Anchor. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rate and review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. So this week we are revisiting a old classic, North by Northwest, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. This is a retroactive synopsis, but like, this is the synopsis of the movie, basically. So this classic suspense film finds New York City ad executive Roger O. Thornhill, played by Cary Grant, pursued by ruthless spy Philip Van Damme, played by James Mason, after Thornhill is mistaken for a government agent. Hunted relentlessly by Van Damme's associates, the harried Thornhill ends up on a cross-country journey, meeting the beautiful and mysterious Eve Kendall, played by Eve Marie Saint, along the way. Soon, Van Damme's henchmen close in on Thornhill, resulting in a number of iconic action sequences. So, yeah. Again, it's post this film because they called it iconic already. So, yeah. But anyways, Dale, tell us your thoughts on this film.
I mean, it's amazing. Like, watching this movie, you could see that is the precursor to, like, the modern spy kind of movie, in a way. You know, a lot of its footprints, you know, are still being shown today. And it's also kind of funny considering the fact that we think Hitchcock, we only think horror or, you know, those kind of things, when Hitchcock has a large catalog of also of movies of this kind of breadth, kind of thriller suspense like Rear Window and whatever, or Dial M for Murder. But yeah, the influence from this movie is still seen today, and it's kind of funny that we talk about this movie with, you know, Mission Impossible coming out in a couple weeks. So, but yeah, this movie, watching it, you really see why it is iconic and timeless in a way.
Yeah, I think I heard someone say that Cary Grant was like a Bond who never was, but this is also like a Bond movie that never was. Yeah. And I definitely agree that this was like the blueprint for like the Bond films, for Mission Impossible, for films along those lines. Jason Bourne even probably. So yeah, I think that this film really hinges or really rests on Cary Grant's shoulders, and he did an incredible job. Like, I know that he and Hitchcock were very closely associated with each other. They did a lot of films together. And this was a really fun movie. Like, this is my first full Hitchcock film. Like, I've seen bits of Psycho. I think I've seen, like, a little bit of To Catch a Thief. Like, I haven't seen, like, a full film of his all the way through. Because I was watching Bates Motel, which is, like, it's not a sequel, it's like a prequel to Psycho.
Yeah.
So I never finished watching Psycho because of that. But I will say, like, this was like fun. Like, this was like a really fun, funny movie. And I wasn't expecting that necessarily from one of his films. Especially because of like how iconic it actually is. Like, a whole festival is like named or like renamed because of this movie. Like, this is a big deal, and I can definitely see why. Like, I saw the plane sequence before I even like really knew what this movie was, but I just enjoyed it a lot because it was just like it seemed like a film like that wasn't taking itself too seriously, but was also like, I think, calling back to a lot of the things that Hitchcock had already done in his previous films. And I saw someone review this. So these aren't my thoughts, but like, I saw someone review this who said that this was like the last big movie that he was going to do to kind of like reset, because a lot of his films had been basically the same. Like, they had a certain consistency to them. And, he kind of did this as like a big hurrah before he like cleaned the slate and did Psycho, because Psycho is like the next movie he did right after this one. So, and that really broke the mold from like how his films were perceived. So yeah, I totally get that. I will say that like this movie is visually really interesting, and I think that's probably Hitchcock's most consistent theme, is like, it's always going to look really cool, and it does. So.
Yeah, you mentioned Cary Grant like being James Bond. This movie, and it's funny, like because you know I'm a big James Bond nerd, but actually, he was Albert Broccoli, who was one of the original producers of the James Bond films, his best man at his wedding. Cary Grant was his best man at the wedding, and he actually approached him to do the movie, the first Dr. No, which ended up being Sean Connery. But Cary Grant himself did not sign on to it because they wanted at least a three-picture deal from the actor, and he only did one. But going beyond that, in this movie, and if you watch James Bond, you really do see a lot of elements of James Bond in this movie, particularly that cat and mouse game. Cary Grant plays with Eve Saint Marie, who played in the movie, where they kind of go back and forth. They're viewed as sexual equals in a way, like both playing around with each other with their innuendos and whatnot. And usually up until this time, a lot of these movies, it was usually always the man in a dominant position and the woman always acquiescing to his women going along with it. And you see that still now today in modern action cinema, where both the guys and the girls can be both interplayed with their sexuality with no issue. At the time when this movie came out, men were mostly held in the dominant position regarding that. But if you look at Cary Grant's filmography, he kind of paved the four-way for leading men, allowing the leading ladies to get agency because he always viewed his leading ladies as partners. It even goes beyond this. I think he did a movie with Audrey Hepburn. And Audrey Hepburn is like in her early 20s and Cary Grant's like 55 years old. And you still see that even though I'm an older man, I'm not gonna force it. It's more Audrey pushing him into it. So like this movie has a lot of its thumbprints on the way modern Hollywood operates. Even beyond that, like watching this movie, you see a lot of rear projection on a lot of scenes, like in the cars when they're walking. Like that's a precursor to green screening that we do, or even beyond that now, which shows up like the Mandalorian that use a lot of LED walls for their scenes. You have matte painting in there for like the interior of the UN. Same process. Everybody knows that the first Star Wars movie for a lot of the scenes inside the Death Star or other locales were matte painted. This movie did that before that, and so it's not just the idea of the action movie in this movie, but how much they use like technology of their time in their movie, much like we do now today. And you see in watching this movie, if you're coming back like I said before, Mission Impossible or any modern James Bond movie, you can see how far technology we've also gone with viewing those elements.
Yeah, you made a good point about Eve Kendall, who is the leading lady of this film. Again, speaking to a review I watched, where they said that most of Hitchcock's, the classic Hitchcock blonde female, wasn't in like any position of power or agency. Like the story wasn't really about her, and this story really is about these two people. And the fact that it's not just that she has sexual agency, but also she just has agency overall. Like she is like dictating a lot of the things that are happening, a lot of the plot points that are gonna continue throughout the film. And I liked that too, because like again, that was kind of surprising to me that like this woman got to have such a huge role in this and like played a huge part in this, because I don't know, I just wasn't expecting that. And I think that she carries a lot of the film, has a lot of charisma as well. And she's also complex. Like she's not like a perfect angel. Like she does some really crazy things in this, which made me like her even more. So I like that he was like subverting the expectations that other people probably already had on his movies at that time, and just doing something a little bit different, which I really enjoyed. Also, I just wanted to talk about the actual story of it, which is like this ad executive Roger, who is mistaken for someone else who doesn't even exist. And I liked that. Basically, he's really stupid in a lot of in a lot of parts. Like he just does some like really dumb stuff. Like, and it makes him look even more guilty in the stupid things that he does. But I also like that he does things that are a little bit smart. Like, my favorite scene in this, I know how iconic the plane scene is, but my favorite scene in this is actually the auction scene where he's, like, goading the police to come arrest him so he can get out of the situation. And he's, like, undercutting however much something is worth. I thought that was so funny. And also just, like, a smart way to get out of a difficult situation, which I really liked. Because, I mean, there was some punching and, like, guns and stuff involved in this film. But my favorite kind of, I guess, interpretation of, like, the action hero or, like, the hero who is, like, in a bind is when they actually have to think about things first before they, like, punch their way out of a situation. So that was really fun for me, and I really enjoyed that scene. But yeah, I like that he does, like, some smart things as the movie continues, but he also does, like, really dumb things because it kind of breaks down the whole, like, macho, like, I'm 10 steps ahead of everyone else, like, I have everything figured out. Like, I like that he was kind of stupid. Yeah. Or maybe he would just act like anyone else would in that situation who's, like, just got kidnapped out of nowhere. Like, yeah, I thought that was really good.
Yeah, he's, like, his, Cary Grant is, like, a weird actor. Like, we see elements of him, and, like, I think the closest approximation to be Cary Grant would be, like, George Clooney nowadays.
Yeah.
Who's, like, revered as far as that natural charisma that, like, oh, man, this dude. But in this movie, he kind of plays more of an everyman role. Yes, he's a New York ad executive, but, like you said, he's kind of a, he's more so, like, within this genre, you have the, you have Get Smart, which is kind of a bumbling idiot who's a spy. Whereas Cary Grant, even though he's a New York ad executive, he's more in line with Don Draper. He still plays the everyman in this role. He's not, you know, a super bumbling idiot, and he's not James Bond. He's not Jason Bourne. He's not the most tactically savvy. He's really trying to, just like a regular dude, how do I deal with these situations? And I think that was, they highlighted his, both his stupidity and his intelligence. Like the scene where he's in the UN and the guy gets, like, stabbed in the back. He holds a knife, and then like, why would you do that? Why would you hold the knife? And
right.
But then as the movie progresses, he kind of, like, he levels up and gains the skill, like a natural progression and understanding of the situation. Like, so I liked also seeing that growth in him as a person. Because before, he was just, like, bumbling through it. Oh, the cops will believe me. And after he realized the rest of the way, then he's like, okay, I can use the cops as a tool to get out because they're going to arrest me, so I avoid the situation, and so forth and so on. So I really love that portrayal of a spy. Like the idea of becoming a spy magically is kind of far-fetched, but his portrayal really grounds the role. Like, for the whole, it really sold more of the mistaken identity part, which was the real linchpin of the movie.
Right. And yeah, exactly what you're saying. I feel like every single time he's, like, almost about to get something right, something bad happens to him. But yeah, I think that theme of, like, the mistaken identity and, like, not, like, you're not actually a spy, so you're not really sure how to deal with the situations, was really a clever way to do this, I think. Because even towards, like, right up until the end, where he figures out the plot of, like, the Russians and what they're about to do before they get on the plane to leave, he writes the note to Eve, and then he, like, throws it and, like, drops it in her lap. But him trying to get out of the house, the maid sees him in the reflection of the TV. So it's not even like he's able to escape sneakily. Like, he still gets caught and has to, like, figure his way out of that too. So even at, like, the basically the end of the film, it's so funny. Like, he still isn't quite there because he's not, like, this isn't his occupation. Like, he doesn't know how to do this. He's just been roped into this crazy situation, which is fun. Like, I guess my biggest takeaway from this film was, like, I didn't expect it to be as fun as it was. I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, kind of, like, this movie does a really good job, I think, of also subverting your expectations of what you expect from a movie, which Hollywood does not really do anymore, you know? So, yeah, and yeah, it's an amazing movie. Also, the movie, even beyond that, deals with a lot of, like, social stuff, because at one point when they're in the train car, like, Eve is like, yeah, I don't really deal with men like you. What do you mean, men like me? He's like, oh, men who don't believe in love. And he's like, he kind of points, like, I believe in love. I've been married twice. He goes, that's my point. like, once again, that George Clooney-esque of him is that eternal playboy, you know, not really like love and being tied down kind of thing. So like beyond the typical action movie, there are also still social things that the movie is still trying to communicate and showcase.
Yeah, I liked how, well, first of all, the fight scenes in this were the thing that took me out the most. Like, oh my god, it's so cheesy. Like, it's hilarious. Like, that really, anytime someone got punched, I was like laughing my head off. I couldn't believe it. Hilarious, like absolutely hilarious. But other than that, I do think that the way that this movie was shot was really interesting too. Like, it's so weird that like some of it looks real and some of it really doesn't. But I think that's like the point, maybe. Like, the night scenes don't look like night, but like it's still it you're able to suspend your belief enough to kind of believe that it is. And then even towards the end when they're like on the Grand, what is it? Not the Grand Canyon.
Mount Rushmore.
And you're like, okay, how are they gonna get back up from, because like the FBI or the CIA or whoever comes to like figure out how to get them out, but I'm like, how are they getting out of here? And they just cut to them on the train. I was like, okay, great, we don't need to know the answer for that. Sure, why not.
Hey, look, I'm that ending, like, I'm still two minds about it. I mean, you know, and it's weird, it's the modern cinema side of me. I was like, that ending is weak. And then you have to also understand the Hitchcock side and then the overall story side. Like, it made sense thematically to like cut, like grab on and then, you know, iris close, iris open, and they're on the train. And, you know, they ended with the innuendo of, you know, them in the train going in the tunnel, sexual innuendo. It's very, like I said, James Bond-esque, that ending. But also, it just felt disjointed because she's dangling for her life on the edge of, like, George Washington's nose. And then we open back up with them on the train all cuddly and whatever. But, you know, I guess, like, you gotta... And that's one of those endings you gotta just hand-wave, like, look, whatever else happens is not important, you know? So, but yeah. And it's... I think the ending also ended that way because I think this movie... Like, this movie is, like, 2 hours and 15 minutes. And then also, I think the studio was like, no, this movie just needs to be under 2 hours. But Hitchcock, you know, at the time when all these movies were made, Hitchcock was the man in Hollywood. And he went back and spoke to his agent, and they're like, yeah, you have final say on your pictures. So he was like, fuck it. got a bang. So that's Hitchcock. That's the kind of power he had. But yeah, the ending is still kind of hokey. Anyway, but then again, you have to understand that what that era of Hollywood was. Hokey kind of always worked in a way. So,
yeah, it was giving me camp. It was giving it was giving me a lot of that. But in terms of like the issues I had with this movie, because I do have issues with it, one of it is that, yes, let's talk about that runtime. It's so long, and it's long because they're not cutting scenes where they need to be cut. So it's not like that the scenes in there are not purposeful. It's just that they run too long.
Yeah.
So I know one of the scenes, which is when he's driving drunk in Glen Cove. It's like, why is this scene so long? Like, they're definitely, and he's giving us like the same like four facial expressions. So it's like, you can cut this down. Like, it didn't need to be that long. And the scene when they're in the train and they're like kissing, which is so weird because I guess I don't know, maybe it was the censors or something of the day where you couldn't like get like a full makeout, so people were just like smushing their faces on each other, and then it's just like, it was weird, and that made me feel weird. But I guess that's just my modern, like, I know what it's supposed to look like, so because it doesn't look like that because it was like 1957 or whatever, it was just a little cringe for me, I'm not gonna lie. But like, there are certain scenes that could have been cut down, and I just feel like I don't understand why they weren't, because this movie had no right to be as long as it did. Like, I'm gonna just say that right now. Like, this movie was the longest crust. But I mean, again, there the scenes in there make sense. It's just that it's like they the editor, whoever it was, like should have just snipped, snip. And then also my issue that kind of goes back to Hitchcock himself of like there are no black people in this movie. Like the black people are backgrounds, which I guess makes sense considering the time period. I still don't like it though. I understand that it was 1957, like. We couldn't even vote at that time, but I'm just saying, like, it does when you watch it back from a 2023 perspective, it does feel weird that like all the black people are like just in service or like, you know, that's their role. I don't like it, and there also aren't just any other people of color in it either. So it's just, yeah, the vibe is weird. And it's weird because like Hitchcock, I feel like, was a very modern filmmaker. Like his ideas of like how he was gonna, his ideas and the stories that he told were kind of cutting edge. Like, I want to see Rope because Rope is like a queer film and that was made like in the 50s. So to me, it's like you could have been on the cutting edge of just having more people of color in your films as well. Since this is the movie where we're subverting expectations, I feel like we could have done that here. So, but then I don't know, Hitchcock seems a little weird to me. Like, I didn't talk about this on our main review, but a few weeks ago I did watch a documentary about him, and he like didn't even care about the actors. His movies were about him. Yeah. And then everyone else just came to play. That's basically what he was doing. So he didn't really value, I guess, the craft of acting or like anything else other than his singular vision. So again, I have issues around him too. It's like, I don't know. It's a weird thing to engage with now. I think you can definitely separate it and be like, no, this movie is still good regardless. But I just, yeah, those are just the little things that did make me go, eh.
Yeah, that's one of those artists separate from the art kind of things, but when in this context it doesn't really work the same way, because you have to also look at the time period and the sensibilities that were at play in a way. Everybody likes to throw separate the artists and the artists from their work if they're a bad person. Like it makes sense, and like if you're looking at, you know, R. Kelly, that kind of sense, because that's morally abhorrent wrong. But when you're looking at stuff where, okay, there are no black people of prominence in the film, I kind of let it go a bit because of the time period it was set in, kind of thing. I wish there was more effort placed by Hollywood, but then again, we see issues with Hollywood dealing with race and hiring black people behind and in front of the screen. It was much, much worse back then. Like, Hattie McDaniels won an Oscar, and she had to sit way in the back, segregated. And I don't think she even got to take her picture. Her Oscar award still hasn't been replaced since it's been lost. So there's been some growth in Hollywood, but not enough growth. So I kind of, with that, since I kind of let Hitchcock slide in a way with that. But yeah, but back to your thing about certain scenes. I didn't mind the whole kissing scene with them because they've continued that interplay of, you know, that each other chasing each other with their dialogue. I do think the scene that took so long was when they cut to them both in the her room in the the train. And this is before the FBI or police comes in and he's talking, hitting in the cab, and I was like, that can go. They could have just did a jump and have him do a slow reveal, and it would have probably worked better. Like, oh, where'd he go? And then the police are gone, and he goes, she pops him and goes, well, how'd you like it in there? He could say, oh, I feel like a pack of sardines. That would have worked fine. I do think a lot of those scenes where they do the rear projection of them walking a straight line, it's like too much dialogue. I do think a lot of that could have been cut out. And because they're also dealing with rear projection, you really do not have a secondary cutaway a lot of times for a different shot. Like, looking at it with a modern sensibilities and modern editing styles and stuff like that, kind of being trapped and focus on that one singular shot for a long time kind of does wear the audience out. Because as much as films are auditory medium, they're a visual medium, and important dialogue might be being said, but because I'm stuck on this monotonous static shot for a while, you're still not processing everything. I do like the part when they were talking, he was talking to the secret agent of when they're on the tarmac, where you couldn't hear anything they're saying because the helicopter or the plane fired up. I thought that was ingenious. Because I like, that's those are one of those kind of things where the audience can't hear it, but the actors can hear it, and we're going to cut back and reveal to it later, which what they did. They went over their plan before he showed up in Route Rushmore to save her. Like, I love those kind of things, but I do think you're right. Certain things could be cut out and removed, but remember, this is the era where directors kind of got carte blanche as far as the length of their movies, you know, no matter what, to a degree.
Yeah, I don't, and again, I don't know if I felt like certain scenes need to be removed. I think I just wanted them to be shorter. That's how I felt about it.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like whenever you watch classic films, you do have to go in with the degree of, like, this was made in a certain time in history. And I think that that's fine. Like, I feel like you can still enjoy a film. Well, it depends on who. It depends on what. It depends on who went and what exactly went down. But I think you can still enjoy something and also say, there's certain parts of it that made me feel a little uncomfortable. Like, I think that that's okay. I think you can, again, it's nuanced. It's layered. It's, you know, modern sensibilities mixing with history. And again, it is interesting to watch movies in this time period because directors really did have, like, so much control over, like, what was being made versus now where it's more studios who have the control over it. And studios did have control, a lot of control back in the day. But I think they had more control over, like, the performers, and I think the directors had all of the control over the movies. So it is interesting to see movies come out of this era because it really is more about the director than it is about the story or even about the characters or anything like that. So, yeah, it's an interesting, like, film study, I think, to watch some of this stuff. I would say that this movie, like, in comparison to a movie like Casablanca, does feel a little bit more iconic. Like, it actually deserves the iconic status than something like Casablanca. But, and even in that plane sequence, which was really cool, I actually really liked that. To me, that even went on too long. So I was just like, I get it. The plane trying to kill him. I see it. I see a vision.
I do like you said, I do think this movie deserves more of the credit and honor that Casablanca has, because Casablanca is kind of hard to pinpoint as to why it's so great, to be honest, you know. And the only thing I can think of it being great is because a lot of the talent in the movie were, you know, migrants during the war, you know, and it's a kind of a melting pot of those people, you know, and those performances still resisting Nazi oppression. That's the only thing. But there's so many elements in this movie, North by Northwest, but I see its fingerprints across, you know, even not just like action movies, but, you know, romance movies and stuff like that, where I could say, I can even the costuming, like, if they talk about Cary Grant's, like, gray suit, like, on, like, designers with great revere. That's why almost every, you know, movie, even beyond action movies, the guy always has that nice iconic suit. You know, it might not be a full suit and tie, but, you know, you still have the jacket and the pants. Like even that far, you know, elements of, you know, how women are portrayed in modern cinema, how the man can still be a bumbling idiot but still be kind of suave in a way. You know, I see all those elements here. Casablanca, all I hear is, here's looking at you, kid, or, and that's it, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this movie was very, it had so much more influence on like how movies would be made in the future, which is why it deserves the iconic status. And then just to wrap up my thoughts, the costumes were phenomenal. Like everyone looked incredible. That's one of the things I love most about watching movies from this era is the fashion. The fashion gave me so much life. Like Miss Eve was dressing down like every single time. I loved it. And all the suits were amazing and like impeccably tailored. Like, yes, lived for that. Like, this, I will continue to watch these movies just for that. Like, and also the score was really good too. So,
I mean, my last takeaway from it is no matter how successful you are, your parents will always find some reason to complain and criticize. Because this man is a successful, well-known New York ad exec, and his mom in like the first like 15 minutes of the movie is just berating him. So yeah, no matter how successful you are, your parents will always find a reason to knock you down a peg. But yeah, this movie is amazing. Like I enjoyed it. So
Don Draper wishes.
yeah.
That's my wrap up.
Moving on from that, it's time for the box office. Of course it's a big weekend for Disney. And of course the big draw out right now is of course The Little Mermaid. Over the Memorial Day weekend, it made about 104 117.5 million over domestically, but it had some issues overseas. Of course, this is usually a main beyond Marvel, this is Disney's probably main holiday weekend. But in line with Marvel, of course Marvel, they've seen drops in their box office considerably for the last couple of years. Overseas though, this movie did 44% less than the Aladdin remake, so this might be a little air of caution for Disney. Of course, the movie did amazing, predominantly with black audiences and families and women, because representation is always important. So Disney still has some work to figure out as far as why their movies are not raking in the dollars they were in the past. One degree might also be the expectation of this movie's going to be on their streaming platforms in a couple of months, so I can wait it out after I watch the initial viewing that I go to. So, and also this is also, and I think the also issue with these last couple movies for Disney are majority of them have been live action remakes of classic films already established. So me in particular, yes, I love Halle Bailey. I'm so happy for her, Little Mermaid representation, but I'm not going to pay $15 for a movie I saw when I was like 10 years old that I have a VHS copy of that Disney could also just re-release in movie theaters with, HD remake or whatever for DVD. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I'm like, stop redoing things that were fine to begin with. And I, again, love Halle Bailey. So proud of her. Really happy that she is getting to do this and be, they're like little dolls of her, that little girls can have now, which is really sweet. I love that. But also, like, I think some things just work better in animation. And this is probably one of the things that work best when you're talking about mermaids under the sea. Like, anyway.
I mean that part was fine. The issue, of course, with the movie was the same issue Lion King had with animals don't emote the way they emote, but their own way. They're not as expressive visually as we are as humans. So of course you have Sebastian. Like there are certain points where you can't tell what his emotion is, or Flounder. And then you have now, if you follow social media, the issue of I guess people also getting tired of Lin-Manuel Miranda, which I'll still give him a pass because he's an amazing creative, no matter what you think about him. But of course, those concerns, particularly within the black community, dealing with this movie of Awkwafina being featured in it, and the casting choices of, you know, of course, if you're, you know, West Indian, the issue of Sebastian being played by David Diggs, and his excuse for his accent was, oh, he studied Jamaican accents and Trini accents and combined them both together. And if you're from those islands or the Caribbean in general, you know, those are two very different accents. So yeah, it's yeah. I don't like the best option could have just been to hire somebody of Caribbean or West Indian descent in those roles if you wanted authenticity. So I feel like Disney just puts half effort into authenticity. Like, hey, we hired a black person. It's not the correct black person, but it's a black person. So
yeah, that's just the story of Disney, I think. They always do that. And I don't know, because I haven't watched the movie, but from what I'm hearing, it's like, I hear that it's better in like quality than The Lion King. But again, like you said, it still has some of those issues. And also just in those sequences where, like, when they are performing in the sea, it kind of seems like the actors aren't in the same room, which again, doesn't help. That's what I'm saying. So I'm saying, like, just let it be animated. Like, I don't know. I don't understand the decision making on that.
I think what Disney should do, instead of taking your good iconic movies and doing live action remakes, I think you should take your bad movies, you know, your Sword and Stone, your Great Mouse Detectives, you know.
I love Sword and Stone.
But it wasn't the Disney success, you know, post Little Mermaid, and then they had that dead period, and then you had like Tarzan and stuff come after, like Sword and Stone, you know, Great Mouse Detective. Those movies, remake those, you know, because very few people have seen those movies. So, but yeah, so
that was that movie anyway. Moving on to the news. Okay, so the biggest news that had come out last week is that Tina Turner, rock and roll legend, has passed at 83. So music makers and entertainers were quick to react to the news of Tina Turner's death on Wednesday evening, penning touching tributes to the soulful diva across social media. Turner was said to have died peacefully in her home in Switzerland at age 83. So people like Mick Jagger, Gloria Gaynor, Diana Ross, and more lauded the queen of rock and roll as a revolutionary performer and music legend for her contributions to the R&B, rock, and pop landscapes. Angela Bassett, who played her in What's Love Got to Do with It, a movie that I saw way too young, said, "How do we say farewell to a woman who owned her pain and trauma and used it as a means to help change the world? Through her courage in telling her story, her commitment to stay the course in her life, no matter the sacrifice, and her determination to carve out a space in rock and roll for herself and for others who look like her, Tina Turner showed others who lived in fear what a beautiful future filled with love, compassion, and freedom should look like." And it's sweet that they kind of had a relationship a little bit too, I think. So what Tina Turner said to her was that, like, "You never mimicked me. You reached deep down into your soul and found your inner Tina," which I think was really sweet. Beyonce even, I think she performed a couple of her songs during her tour that's going on right now. And she said that she loved her endlessly. I know they had an iconic, like, a duo at the Grammys. I remember that performance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she made a huge impact on the music industry, but just, like, in entertainment overall, like, just in the world. A very iconic figure. I remember her story and even listening to her music. And how she's inspired so many other artists who are continuing today. So it is a huge loss.
Yeah, she was very influential on a lot of course, not just black singers, but a lot of white singers, you know, her relationship with Mick Jagger and stuff like that, so on and so forth. Mel B, the Spice Girls, you've mentioned Beyonce. Her story is, like, I think even Lizzo, during one of her shows at her tour this weekend, did a costume change in homage to Tina herself. But yeah, her story is one of, like, the lowest of lows and highest of highs and triumphant. Of course, everybody knows due to Love God's due with her relationship, her issues with, you know, Ike, and then after that, you know, rising to the precipices of fame, and, you know, and then, you know, nearly, I think she had a kidney issue and almost died, and then finding love, and then, you know, moving to Switzerland and all that. It's a very powerful, and it's an ending everybody wants. Like, after your years of struggle and self-doubt, and you finally get the happy ending. And she's one of those people who, like, this goes back to, you know, misogyny, how, especially within our community, you know, we are a Black podcast, going to talk about Black stuff, where I see a lot of, you know, Black men deride the fact that she was living with a white man in Switzerland. That white man made her happy. The white man donated a kidney to her to have her to continue her life. And it's not a slap in the face of Black people or Black men. This is, she found somebody that she loved and was happy with that person. I think the race factor should not play a factor in how we edify Tina Turner in her death. Like, that should not be a thing we complain about. Oh, she didn't like Black people, she married a white man. And no, she's an icon to everybody. Like, even how we talk about people singing in the church, like, her passionate energy still mimicked to this day, you know, even when people form in church. So yeah, I don't think it's a time or a place to drop these, you know, what's the word, these personalized theories that fit your opinion of a person because you don't like their whole story or how they triumphed over the issues in their life.
Yeah, I think this is why I don't exist on Twitter anymore, because that is a descent into madness, whatever is going on over there. Yeah. And also, just to take a minute to talk about that, like, I personally believe you go where you're appreciated. Yeah. And also, like, this is like a little bit of a sidebar, but I feel like there is this feeling amongst Black men, and this is a generalization, obviously it's not everybody, but that feel like they are owed Black women's loyalty, and they don't treat them well. So they don't treat them well, they don't protect them, they're abusive in a lot of cases. In their homes with Black women and having Black children is the only place that they sometimes can feel like they're dominant or they have any type of power, and they abuse that power over those people. So no, like, if she wants to marry whoever she wants to marry of whatever race, like, you just need to accept that and maybe step up. Maybe that won't be the case, but that's a sidebar.
Yeah, I mean, it's to continue the sidebar, sorry, but it's always one of those things I find funny where we're okay with Black men, you know, marrying outside the race. I'm like, oh, he couldn't find, you know, the woman for him within our community, so he had to step up. But when a Black woman does it, it's like a massive stain. Like, you can't be both sides. Either you're for it or against. At least pick a side, stick to it no matter what. So, but yeah.
Yeah, anyways.
Moving on beyond that, of course, it's a big week or weekend-ish for Scorsese. I think his daughter also has a film coming out soon. He supported her as well for that. But, you know, he also, you know, got to meet the Pope, and he's announcing a film about Jesus. He went on a post-Cannes tour of Italy, and he got to meet Pope Francis and announced he's going to make a film about Jesus. He went on to say, I've responded to the Pope's appeal to artists in only the way I know how, by imagining writing a screenplay about the film Jesus that he announced in a press conference in the Vatican. He says he's about to start making it and assesses that this could be his next film. So, like, the history of the church, if you guys aren't aware, like, a lot of these classic paintings, you know, the David, you know, painting of Sistine Chapel, were commissioned by, you know, the Catholic Church. For all their seedy stuff, allegations with child predators and whatnot, they've also been a really big proponent of the arts throughout history. So I'm kind of interested in how this goes. I don't see Scorsese is a weird one. I don't know how he's gonna play Jesus. Like, is Jesus, like, are the 12 disciples just gonna, like, be in the mob or something? Like, you know, based on how Scorsese is, I'm kind of curious as to how he will put this off. He cited inspiration from the Gospel according to St. Matthew and his own he also even spoke about the meaning of his 1988 film, The Last Temptation, Jesus Christ. And it was about the persecution of, I think, Christians in Japan, and it was played in the Vatican in, like, 2016. So, yeah, I'm kind of interested in how this project is going to play out.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what he'll do with it as well. I mean, he did do Silence, which is I guess it has something to do with religion, and that was received pretty well. So I'm sure he can do it. It's not like he can't. But if he makes Jesus white, I will be understanding.
Yeah, Jesus needs to, you know, hair like lamb's wool to be like olive skinned, you know. So
yeah, he better get that right, or I can't stand. Like, it's just like, that's what it is. Yeah. So I'm looking at you, Martin. All right. Was there anything else that you wanted to add?
That's about it. I mean, I think that's okay. The major news, you know, of course, beyond, you know, Succession's ending.
Have you been watching Succession? Do you have thoughts?
No, it's on my list. I was waiting for the show to end to actually start it. I am starting it. Let's watch the last couple of episodes. But I did see a spoiler-ish story about how, and I think the person explained it perfectly, and people kind of laughed it off. She kind of explained how and why writers name their characters, and she kind of said this is the most likely ending due to how people name their characters, and she's like dead on. Like, names aren't chosen at random. In these stories, like, people forget, especially in, I think, Western culture, people forget that names have meanings behind them, and they're more played out within story, you know, whether it's literary mediums, like, the names actually do play into the pattern or the path the story will take. So, and I also like the fact that Succession was one of those shows that, even though it became a hit, they knew they weren't going to keep doing it forever. And I think that's also one of the strengths of HBO as well. Like, they don't force their projects to keep going on. Like, we have a defined beginning and a defined end. We're not going to do like what ABC does or NBC does or CBS does and have like 20 spinoffs of the same show and just keep it going. You know, I love those like miniseries-esque styles of shows.
Yep. Okay, so let's talk about what we've watched. Dale, you watched Mad Max. Was this the remake or was this the original?
This was the Fury Road remake, or not really remake. I think at one point George Miller was like, that was his next idea for the, I think, original three, starring Mel Gibson. I didn't like it. I did not like it. I didn't like it based on the fact that this movie is predicated on the fact that you have had to have seen the Mel Gibson ones. And that does not work nowadays, especially considering that movie was like, those movies are like 40-ish years ago. Mm-hmm. So to expect people to have paid attention to that is absurd. I don't like... If you're going to cast Tom Hardy in a role or give him a role, you got to rewrite the characters and make them dudes British, because accents are not Tom Hardy's wheelhouse. And it felt like his Australian accent was being redubbed by an actual Australian, you know, that wasn't Tom Hardy. I do think all for the representation that Charlize Theron. Charlize has made an amazing career playing strong female characters. I do think that this role is still kind of lacking in a way of her strength-ish. But yeah, it's an okay movie. I was not really interested in it because also the idea of, hey, we're in cars just driving through the desert for 2 hours is not really, with action mixed in every couple of, you know, every like 25-minute window. Yeah, was not the movie for me. So, interested to see how the sequel plays out, because I think the sequel is finally done and it should be releasing next year, I think 2024, which is what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a prequel about Charlize Theron's character, but it's going to be starring Anya Taylor-Joy. Kind of interested in seeing Anya Taylor-Joy in an action-esque role. I don't think she can pull it off, but we'll see.
I don't remember much about Fury Road other than it had a banging soundtrack and the visuals were stunning and Zoe Kravitz was in it. She looked amazing. But yeah, I remember like fragments of it, but like not enough to. I forget if I liked it or not. I thought it was okay. I liked the visuals.
That means it's not memorable.
Yeah.
So,
True. That's true.
yeah.
Yeah. So I watched two things this week. First, I watched the Hillsong docu-series on Hulu. If you guys don't know, or if you forgot about the whole Hillsong drama, Hillsong was a church that came out of Australia, and basically one of its pastors, Carl Lentz, was like one of those celebrity pastors. He was friends with Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez and like a whole bunch of other famous people and athletes. And he cheated on his wife, and that was a whole scandal. But like more than that, the leader of the church, Brian Houston, like his, I don't know, the abuse, the waste of money, the like all of that was something that was kind of just unfolding because of the whole thing that happened with Carl Lentz. And yeah, if you're, even if you're not Christian, I feel like you kind of know who these people are because their names have been thrown into like a whole bunch of scandals. So like, yes, I watched a docuseries on that. It was like, it was very hard to watch it. Honestly, there were some parts in there that were really devastating because a lot of abuse has taken place in that church. And it's not just like physical abuse, it's mental, but also spiritual abuse. Like people aren't going to church anymore because of the stuff that these folks did. And I really hate that. Like that makes me really upset because it's like, people are like craving community. They're craving finding like purpose in their life, meaning in the world. And you're abusing that and like making them work crazy hours, not paying them, physically abusing them, sexually abusing them, pretending to be like about love and, you know, acceptance. But, you know, they're not progressive in any way. They're actually extremely conservative. But they're presenting a certain kind of image. And so, like, you know, people who are queer or people who are even, or black people who aren't getting positions like in leadership and stuff because of their race. The church not really speaking up about issues like, you know, or sexist. I think Carl Lentz was the only pastor in any of those churches who actually spoke about Black Lives Matter. And you know, there's just, you know, just messy stuff that churches are kind of known for now, which is just like a whole bunch of mess. It really just, it sucks because it's like you had an opportunity to do something cool and you decided to just like, it, you decided to just focus on funds and growing churches and like taking people's money. So that sucked. And it was very hard to watch, but it was interesting to see like just the journalistic aspects of like how they uncovered the story. That was interesting to watch. And then I watched God's Creatures, which is a movie starring Emily Watson and Paul Mescal. And I thought that this movie was another movie called God's Own Country, which stars Josh O'Connor, who plays Prince Charles in The Crown, but those movies, I think, came out around the same time, did they? Maybe. But yeah, I got confused. Either way, I really liked this movie too. Sorry, I'm like, I really thought these were the same films, but they're not. They're two completely different things. And this movie, God's Creature, came out last year from A24. The trailer is so A24, like it's so funny, like how they like create trailers that are where you're just like, oh my God, like what is this? It looks so cool. The movie was good. It just wasn't like, I don't know, it wasn't like a standout film, but the performances were amazing. It's about this fishing village in Ireland where a case of abuse takes place, someone is sexually assaulted, and the whole town kind of just rallies around the guy, and the woman is just left to, like, her life is in shambles now, but the guy's mom protects him, so that's why he doesn't get any repercussions, really. So it's like Banshees of Inisherin. It's like, well, just in like the setting, because it's, I don't, it's probably not set in the same place, but it looks very familiar.
Irish.
Yeah, but an Irish in a small town, like not a, not like Dublin or something like that. So yeah, it's kind of like that. It's really interesting though, because it's really quiet and you're like, is anyone gonna say anything about this? And like, they kind of do, but they kind of don't. It's very interesting though. And it's also like a thing that's still taking place. Like, I guess in these smaller communities that are really focused on like religion and like everyone knows each other, when something big like this happens, it is like a huge deal, but people don't really talk about it because that's not the culture over there. So it was an interesting study and like seeing how these kind of things play out. Would recommend it. It is good. So yeah. I watched. Anyway, we hope that you guys are taking care of yourselves and have